My name is Dr. Val Turner. I'm an emergency physician at the Royal Perth Hospital in Western Australia. For the past decade and more, I've been a member of a small group of scientists who have questioned the HIV/AIDS hypothesis. Put simply, we have argued in many published scientific papers that HIV is not the cause of AIDS, and indeed, there is no proof that HIV exists. Some of you listening to this program may feel that such a viewpoint is quite preposterous, even crazy. Indeed, at one level, I would have to agree with your point of view. The HIV theory of AIDS seems as impenetrable as the principle of Archimedes and the laws of Newton and Einstein. But perhaps I could remind you of something attributed to the renowned theoretical physicist Niels Bohr, who said that some ideas are crazy, but also crazy enough to be true. Indeed, there is a strong historical precedent for arguing the non-existence of HIV. In the mid-1970s, Dr. Robert Gallo, the current US HIV scientist, claimed to have discovered the world's first human retrovirus, which he named HL23V. For five exciting years, this virus was presented as a breakthrough in the quest to discover the cause of leukemia. However, in 1980, when it was proven that antibodies to HL23V resulted from everyday exposures to a host of non-viral factors, this virus suddenly disappeared from the annals of science. It is now regarded as a monumental and embarrassing mistake, is never mentioned, and no longer exists. It is the belief of the Perth group of HIV/AIDS dissidents that when there is widespread acknowledgement of the fact that antibodies to HIV arise in circumstances which have nothing to do with the virus, and we will argue that this is always the case, then there is no scientific reason, for continuing to believe in the existence of HIV. This is a view shared by others now. In the October 19th edition of the Toronto Star, a report appeared following a meeting organised by the local chapter of the 10,000-strong North American AIDS dissident group, HEAL. That stands for Health Education AIDS Liaison. The meeting was addressed by Nobel Laureate biochemist and molecular biologist Dr. Curry Mullis, who described how for the past 10 years he has been unable to obtain an answer to the relatively innocuous question, where and what is the proof that HIV causes AIDS? Eventually, Mullis even challenged HIV's discoverer, Professor Luc Montagnier of the Pasteur Institute, but to no avail. Let me read you Mullis's account of this conversation from the foreword he wrote for Peter Duisberg's book, Inventing the AIDS Virus. With a look of condescending puzzlement, Montagnier said, "Why don't you quote the report from the Centers for Disease Control?" I replied, "It doesn't really address the issue of whether or not HIV is the probable cause of AIDS, does it?" "No," he admitted, no doubt wondering when I would just go away. He looked for support to the little circle of people around him, but they were all waiting for a more definitive response, like I was. "Why don't you quote the work on simian immunodeficiency virus?" the good doctor offered. "I read that too, Dr. Montagnier," I replied. "What happened to those monkeys didn't remind me of AIDS. Besides, that paper was just published only a couple of months ago. I'm looking for the original paper where somebody showed that HIV caused AIDS." This time, Dr. Montagnier's response was to walk quickly away to greet an acquaintance across the room. Mullis was eventually led to the conclusion the reason there were no papers proving that HIV was the cause of AIDS was that there were no such papers. Nowadays, Mullis agrees with the Perth group. Quote, "No one has ever isolated HIV. No one has a bottle in their lab called HIV." End of quote. Thus it is small wonder that the English science journalist Neville Hodgkinson has described the HIV theory of AIDS as the greatest scientific blunder of the 20th century. It may be helpful to recall that AIDS dates from 1981, when exponentially increasing numbers of gay men in several large US cities developed two previously rare diseases, the rapidly fatal fungal pneumonia known as pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, or PCP for short, and Kaposi sarcoma, a malignancy of the skin and internal organs. Following the discovery that many of these patients had low numbers of certain immune system cells, known as T4 lymphocytes, in their blood, AIDS became regarded as a consequence of immune deficiency. The problem then became one of finding out why the T4 cells were depleted. Given the scenario of promiscuity, it did not seem at the time unreasonable to postulate the action of a sexually transmitted microbe. The most favoured was a retrovirus because, although these were enigmatic remnants and disease-causing orphans of the Nixon decade war against cancer, two are nonetheless believed to be genuine viruses and have a predilection for T4 cells. It was easy to propose that a putative AIDS-causing retrovirus could kill off T4 cells, leaving the body prone to opportunistic organisms and cancers which normal human bodies readily resist. In 1983, Luc Montagné claimed to have discovered such a virus, sometime later called HIV. The same claim was also made a year later by Dr. Robert Gallo from the US National Institutes for Health. Since I want this to remain principally a scientific talk, I will deliberately avoid the polemics that occurred between the Pasteur Institute in Gallo's laboratory over whether Gallo misappropriated the French virus. Besides making the same discovery as Montagne, Gallo also announced proof that HIV causes AIDS in the development of an antibody test. Later on, when antibodies to HIV were actively sought and found in individuals other than gay men, principally drug users and haemophiliacs, it seemed to clinch matters, and the HIV theory has never looked back. Patients, physicians, public health officialdom embrace it with the zeal of true believers, and nowadays HIV truly does look as secure as Archimedes, Newton, and Einstein. To doubt the HIV theory really does beg the crazy question. This state of scientific serenity was not to last long. In 1987, the highly revered virologist Professor Peter Gersberg from Berkeley, California, published an invited paper in the prestigious journal Cancer Research. In this paper, he concluded that HIV does not cause AIDS. His principal argument at that time was there was insufficient HIV in insufficient T4 cells, even when patients were dying, to do harm. Duisberg calculated that the alleged number of T4 cells lost daily at the behest of HIV was about the same a man would lose cutting himself shaving. Such a low viral burden was an acknowledged fact, but reaction to Duisberg's bombshell immediately led to the closure of ranks and the marginalising and shunning of one of America's most outstanding scientific minds. Eventually, it deprived Duisberg of all research funding. Into this fray stepped Perth biophysicist Eleni Papadopoulos-Eliopoulos. She had begun to research AIDS at its inception in 1981. And by the time Duisberg's paper appeared, she had already received two rejections from the scientific journal Nature for proposing an oxidative stress chemical non-infectious theory to explain the genesis of both low T4 cells and AIDS. The theory had the added bonus of explaining the several laboratory phenomena inferred, although mistakenly in Eliopoulos's view, as proof of the existence of HIV. In Eliopoulos' view, what united AIDS patients and those at risk of developing AIDS was not an infectious microbe, but excessive exposures to a variety of noxious chemical influences that had in common the ability to oxidize cellular constituents. This led to the gradual poisoning of the body in such a manner that it became vulnerable to particular diseases. On the one hand, while Duisberg posited HIV as real but harmless, on the other hand, Eliopoulos argued that the set of laboratory data inferred as HIV was an epiphenomenon. This was an idea considerably backed up by experimental evidence gathered in the retrovirological literature well before the AIDS era. Unfortunately, as debate on this point would predictably split the dissident camp, Eliopoulos and her colleagues long refrained from public debate with Duisberg over this particular issue. It was only in December 1995 when the British gay men's scientific magazine Continuum offered a prize of £1,000 sterling for a paper proving the existence of HIV that Duisberg and Eliopoulos finally engaged publicly in what began and has remained friendly polemics. To an outsider, much of the debate from both sides is shrouded in an almost impenetrable fog of virological, immunological, biochemical, and molecular biological jargon. Someone wishing to fully comprehend the basic scientific issues must be prepared to spend months immersed in unfamiliar concepts and language. In Eliopoulos' view, this unpalatable fact has been a most significant factor in the preservation of the HIV protagonist's hallowed ground at almost at zero effort. This, along with a leading journal editor's virtual refusal to publish and hence publicise dissension, means that the general public is lucky to ever find out there is a debate. The unconscious expectation that such censorship will be circumvented by fair and open-minded investigative journalism has been rendered virtually inoperable by the established experts inveighing against such intrusions on the basis of their own legitimacy and citing threats to public health. Thus, it is small wonder that the void has become populated by a variegated collection of scientists, including two Nobel laureates, as well as many non-professional scientists, academics, journalists, patients and relatives, and perhaps surprisingly to some, a fair number of gay men. Nonetheless, the patient and persistent efforts of this group are in reality spendthrift in relation to the established order of scientists and government and big business institutions. Over the past decade, the frustration felt by the authentic stakeholders has spurned numerous dissident organisations, magazines, books and television documentaries, including most recently a very strong resolve to bring the issue into courts of law. As far as the Perth group is concerned, for some time now, our aim has been to force an adjudicated debate at an international level. The formation of a critical mass of people is the key to unlocking the power of public opinion required to bring about such an event. I would now like to discuss some of the scientific debate. And in doing so, I would like to introduce this topic with a quotation from A Brief History of Time by the theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking. A theory is a good theory if it satisfies two requirements. It must accurately describe a large class of observations on the basis of a model that contains only a few arbitrary elements, and it must make definite predictions about the results of future observations. To paraphrase these words, we could say, wrong predictions affirm bad theories, correct predictions make them powerful. If we assume that HIV does exist as a bona fide infectious, that is, a particle of appropriate constitution and appearances able to reproduce itself inside living cells, the HIV theory predicts that all AIDS patients will be infected with HIV, all AIDS diseases are caused by HIV, via sexual activity with prostitutes, HIV and AIDS will spread initially from its nucleus of gay men and drug users into the larger heterosexual community, HIV kills T4 cells, a vaccine will be forthcoming, an animal model of HIV infection causing AIDS will be developed. So far, none of these predictions has been fulfilled. AIDS can be legally diagnosed without HIV infection, which we'll discuss further in due course. HIV has not spread beyond the original risk groups. There is now agreement that Kaposi sarcoma, one of the two diseases for which the retroviral hypothesis was first proposed, is not caused directly or indirectly, that is, via immune deficiency, by HIV. There is no proof that HIV kills T4 cells. Few, if any, non-drug-taking prostitutes are HIV positive. The world still awaits the vaccine predicted by the end of 1986. And although monkeys have been given copious quantities of HIV and become HIV positive, none have developed AIDS. In fact, this year, US senators were contemplating how best to retire 1,500 chimpanzees bred for AIDS research, and which are currently languishing in cages at an annual cost to the US taxpayer of $7.3 million. Let us contrast the HIV theory to the Eliopoulos oxidative stress theory. The oxidative stress theory predicts the current demographic data, that is, similar, for example, to the non-infectious vitamin deficiency diseases pellagra and scurvy, HIV/AIDS will remain confined to the original risk groups. It also predicts the risk of passive anal intercourse in both sexes, an apparent loss of T4 cells from the bloodstream, HIV-positive and AIDS patients being oxidized relative to normal individuals, the improvement in various HIV and AIDS parameters by the use of antioxidants, and a non-infectious animal model. Every one of these predictions has materialized. In addition to the failure to spread and the risk of passive anal intercourse in both sexes, oxidative stress is well established by hundreds of papers, so much so that in the early 1990s the Pasteur Institute was advertising international scholarships to study the phenomenon. This year, Luc Montagne became the principal editor of a 558-page book devoted to oxidative stress in cancer, aging, and AIDS. The Eliopoulos theory predicts a decline in T4 cells without cell death. According to the scientific evidence, there is no evidence that the T4 cells are even dead in AIDS patients, let alone killed by HIV. For example, in T4 cell cultures, the same number of T4 cells disappear regardless of whether one adds what is said to be HIV or merely the chemical stimulants obligatory to obtain the HIV. As Eliopoulos proposed at the beginning of the AIDS era, the T4 cell count may be low either because the T4 cells are selectively sequestrated in tissues removed from the bloodstream, or because they are altered such that the antibody used to measure their numbers will no longer bind to their surface. An examination of the scientific data also reveals lack of proof that the low numbers of T4 cells are necessary or sufficient to produce the diseases characterizing the clinical syndrome known as AIDS. This means, for example, that the AIDS diseases may appear in individuals who have T4 cell counts within the normal range, or may never appear in individuals who have reduced numbers of T4 cells, even in those who have continuously profoundly diminished numbers of T4 cells. Thus, a decade after her 1988 medical hypotheses paper, we find experts such as Dr. Arthur Anderson from the US Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Disease and Dr. Ziv Grossman at the University of Tel Aviv taking Eliopoulos' ideas and using them to question the central tenet of the HIV theory, that is, virus-induced killing of immune system cells leading to AIDS. Nonetheless, and despite so much evidence to the contrary, the orthodox view remains firmly entrenched. In fact, since 1993, the low numbers of T4 cells has been enshrined in the 1993 CDC AIDS definition, whereby AIDS can be diagnosed without a disease. Consistent also with the Eliopoulos oxidative stress theory is the fact that the only animal model of AIDS is non-infectious. Mice repeatedly exposed to foreign cellular proteins develop a dramatic depletion of T4 cells, Kaposi sarcoma-like tumours and, abundant retroviral-like particles appear in their spleens. Thus, in the only animal model, AIDS diseases are followed by the production of retroviral-like particles and not the other way around. To the uninitiated, this may come as a surprise. However, it has been long known that retroviruses arise even in uninfected cell cultures because all cells contain retroviral genetic information inherited from parents. Humans are no exception. Of the 100,000 or so genes making up human DNA, that is the human DNA genome, at least 1% consists of endogenous retroviral information. This represents an amount approximately 3,000 times larger than the putative HIV genome. Such information is switched into production mode by the oxidative conditions that exist in the AIDS risk groups and by the oxidant chemicals which are obligatory in cultures to obtain HIV. The highly implausible notion that a single microbe could cause such a diverse collection of what now amounts to 30 disorders gained credence only because of an hypothesized link under the guise of immune deficiency. This meant low numbers of T4 cells, which Gallo nominated as the, quote, hallmark, unquote, of AIDS. However, even in 1981, there was no precedent for such an all-embracing synthesis. It was well recognized that the vast majority of people diagnosed with cancer are not immune deficient, and of those who are, many whose cancer can be surgically removed will recover their immunity. In other words, either cancer causes immune deficiency or some other factor or factors underlies both conditions. Likewise, virtually all people destined to develop most infectious diseases in the immediate future are currently immune competent. Their diseases may well depress their immunity, as they might other body organs and systems, but only for as long as it takes patients to recover. For Iliopoulos and our group, the proposal that depressed immunity is a prerequisite for AIDS resulted from the coincidental development of technology to count T4 cells just before the discovery of HIV. But since physicians and the general public alike are prone to uncritical, almost wishful acceptance of immunity as a panacea for all that is good and bad with health, immune deficiency was an idea that needed little justification within the HIV paradigm. The Perth group contend that it is possible to appreciate the failure of the HIV theory without delving into the difficult and tedious business of retroviral isolation. This can be done simply by examining many facets of the HIV theory and posing the question, what properties would a virus need to explain the observed data? As I hope to show you, it would need so many crazy properties that eventually, from this many-angled approach, we gather an impetus to examine the more technical virological evidence. Let us take a look at the AIDS definition. The AIDS definition is set out by the US CDC as a, quote, CDC surveillance case definition for AIDS, end of quote. The latest edition was in 1993. Using the AIDS definition, it should be utterly impossible to arrive at a diagnosis of AIDS by any means that violates the HIV theory of AIDS. But this is not the case. In the OECD countries, including the US and Australia, using the CDC definition, AIDS can be diagnosed with Kaposi sarcoma, which even Gallo accepts is not caused by HIV, in the absence of immune deficiency, without laboratory evidence of HIV infection, and extraordinary, in the presence of negative results for HIV infection. If AIDS were physics, these data alone would send the whole theory back to the drawing board. Let us now consider some data related to blood transfusion. It seems watertight, doesn't it? An individual receives a blood transfusion, 3 months later is HIV positive, and by year's end is dead from AIDS. Conclusive proof that HIV causes AIDS? Of course not. 50% of HIV antibody positive American blood transfusion recipients die within 1 year of transfusion. That is true. But so do 50% of HIV negative transfusion recipients. In fact, within 3 years, 60% of the latter will be dead. If HIV antibodies are proof of HIV infection and HIV causes AIDS, then the risk of developing AIDS could be the same risk as becoming HIV positive. However, the risk of AIDS increases 3 to 6 times faster with the volume of blood transfused than does the risk of becoming HIV positive. Likewise, HIV positive transfusion recipients are 50 times more likely to develop AIDS within a year than HIV positive hemophiliacs. Clearly, even if HIV were necessary to cause AIDS, it cannot be the only factor. However, rather than treating these data as a scientific and moral imperative to examine the total HIV-AIDS hypothesis, experts chose instead to prop up an ailing theory by inventing the idea of cofactors. That is, factors other than HIV which are necessary for HIV to produce AIDS. However, this is severely problematic, as one is then faced with an array of possible causations under which it is difficult to judge the significance of any. Theoretically, HIV could be a minor factor given this scenario, or perhaps not a factor at all. It is instructive to realise that each year in the US, approximately 4 million blood transfusions are performed. Amongst these, a significant number administered for the treatment of cancer and to patients who have or had had surgical procedures, including organ transplants, infections, radiation, antibiotics, anti-cancer and steroid drugs, and psychological stress. Any of these factors are associated with immune suppression, the development of AIDS-defining illnesses, and death. Furthermore, blood transfusions themselves are immune suppressive, and of course are only performed at hospitals. Interestingly, patients attending hospitals have a high rate of HIV antibodies even when patients in the well-known risk groups, as well as patients with meager risks such as trauma, are excluded. St. Louis and his colleagues reported a study of 26 US hospitals, and in some of these hospitals, 20% of no known risk men and 8% of similar women aged 25 to 44 were found to be HIV positive. Transfusion of HIV negative blood may be followed by the development of HIV antibodies, and transfusion of one's own externally irradiated blood has the same effect. From these data, one cannot help but wonder whether HIV antibodies have anything whatsoever to do with exposure to a virus, or perhaps arise for some other reason, such as the foreign nature of transfused blood, or similar multiple and varied immune stimuli associated with whatever diseases underlie the need for transfusion. From here, it is only a small step to an appreciation that individuals in all the AIDS risk groups, including the populations of developing countries, are likewise exposed. Since the only animal model shows that repeated injections of immune-challenging foreign proteins cause the development of AIDS-like diseases, as well as a variety of antibodies that react with the HIV proteins, the question naturally arises, why does one need to invent HIV to explain AIDS? It is now time to examine some of the large amount of data concerned with sexual transmission of HIV. HIV-AIDS is claimed to be bidirectionally sexually transmitted. Data to support this claim are not based on microbial isolation and contact tracing, as is the orthodox practice for proving diseases are infectious and sexually transmitted, but on mostly retrospective studies. These studies include highly selected groups of individuals, including gay and bisexual men, heterosexual men, and women, including prostitutes. These studies compare specific sexual practices with the risk of being and rarely becoming HIV positive. The first studies reported naturally, were on gay men. In 1984, Gallo and his colleagues showed that of 8 different sexual acts, a positive HIV antibody test correlated only with receptive anal intercourse. They also found the more often a gay man has insertive anal intercourse, the less likely he was to become HIV positive. This, of course, is incompatible with an infectious cause. In 1986, Gallo and his colleagues reported they found no evidence that other forms of sexual activity contribute to the risk of becoming HIV positive in gay men. In an extensive review of 25 studies in gay men reported in 1994, the authors concluded that, quote, no or no consistent risk of the acquisition of HIV-1 infection has been reported regarding insertive intercourse, end of quote. In the West, again, the largest and most judiciously conducted prospective epidemiological studies, such as the multi-center AIDS cohort study, so-called MAC study, of 4,955 gay men, have proven beyond all reasonable doubt that in gay men, the only significant sexual act related to becoming HIV antibody positive is receptive anal intercourse. Thus, in gay men, AIDS may be likened to pregnancy. It is sexually acquired by the passive partner, but is not sexually transmitted to the active partner. Significantly, the MAC study also showed that once a gay man becomes HIV positive, progression to AIDS is further determined by the amount of passive anal intercourse sustained after the alleged infection. This is contrary to all that is known about infectious diseases. One infection, and not repeated infections, is all that is necessary to cause disease. Indeed, in Australia, although the Royal Australasian College of Surgeons considers HIV-positive surgeons to be infectious and should not perform invasive procedures or operations, they are permitted to provide these services to patients who have the same infection.
This is the end of part 1.